Welcome back to The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. My name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark. And I'm very pleased to be rejoined today by the Entertainment Strategy Guy, one of my favorite Substack newsletters. He's also at The Ankler. We're going to be talking a little bit about one of his Ankler pieces today, whether or not there is a double standard between how people talk about the tech-based streamers and the rest of the more traditional studio-run streamers. We can get into that. We're going to talk about the best and the worst of 2023, what succeeded, what failed, what we should be thinking when we think about theatrical versus streaming and all that. But it's great to have you back on. Thanks.
Glad to be here and always excited to talk ratings. And that Inkler article I had, I know it was pretty buzzy. I heard you guys talk about it on Across the Movie Aisle, and happy to chat about it more.
We did it. That was our controversy or non-troversy segment of this week. So I was like, I should just get him on to talk about it. We'll just pick his brain directly. It's great. All right. So let's talk. First, let's talk about best and worst of 2023. So it takes a couple weeks, takes 3 or 4 weeks for the ratings numbers to come in. Then you got to compile it and collate it, et cetera, et cetera. So we've got some data now. Here's what jumped out at me about the top 10 films of the year of 2023, which is that Leave the World Behind, the biggest movie of 2023, the biggest streaming movie of 2023, should couch it that way, because here is a movie that I know was a huge hit. I saw the numbers as they were coming out, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. But it didn't really hit me until I was looking back at some of these charts this week and thinking about how no one has ever mentioned this movie to me ever. Not even like in 2024, not even like 5-6 months later or however long it's been. But I mean, like, even when it was out, nobody. I'm a movie reviewer. I'm a film critic. People are constantly coming up to me saying, Sonny, I need to know what you think about Monkey Man. I need to know what you think about the new Ghostbusters movie. Zero people have ever mentioned this movie to me in my real life. Zero. And I just think, it's such, and I understand this is anecdata. You don't traffic in anecdata. You traffic in data. But this is just, it's such a telling thing for me where I have this entirely misperceived notion of the world of streaming. So it was Leave the World Behind the biggest movie of last year in streaming.
It was the biggest. Actually, I'll say no, it was not.
Oh.
With a slight caveat. If we're taking the full span of it. But so you're right, I don't traffic in anecdotes. But I do like anecdotes as a starting point. And I was at a... I don't do very many. I try and be clear on that. That, like, I tend to just stay in my little hobbit hole, the Excel bunker, as I call it. But I was with two industry people, and I asked them circa January what the 5 biggest films on streaming were, and I said they were all on Netflix, and they could not tell me what the films were. But then I asked, and when, like, I could do it with you, like, what was the name as many of the top 5 biggest theatrical movies of last year, and how many can you name, like?
I mean, I could. Well, this is not a fair question to ask me because I do frequently go to box office. But it would be what? So it's Barbie, Super Mario Brothers. It's probably Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Oppenheimer's up there as well.
Oppenheimer. Did Oppenheimer make the top 5?
It did in the U.S. Yeah. And so that's why I primarily traffic. And that'll be my caveat for the entire conversation. I'm primarily using U.S. data because that's where we have the most robust data. The only streamer that publishes global data is Netflix, and we very much appreciate that because it allows us to double check things. But we'll be having a U.S. conversation for the most part, but some of these things will extrapolate. So anyways, back to your question. When it comes to streaming-only films, so films that premiered first on streaming, I call these first-run films, Leave the World Behind was absolutely the biggest film of 2023. And actually, it is Netflix's number one first-run streaming film because I classify Glass Onion as an early film because it hit a significant theatrical run, but it would be number 2 behind Glass Onion. That's the only bigger one. Mm-hmm. The only film that is bigger, and this is in terms of total hours viewed, if you're taking unique customers who watched it probably would not get that, but no one publishes that data, is actually the Super Mario Brothers movie. Because it's run, if you add up what it did on Peacock and then what it did on Netflix to date, it actually has the most hours of any film that came out on streaming in 2023. So Super Mario Brothers is the most by total hours. And actually, if you go just by total hours viewed, it actually is bigger than, according to Nielsen, it is bigger than it's Netflix's biggest film of all time.
So that's, I mean, look, that's, that's wild. That's why, again, that is a wild statement to make. And it kind of blows my mind, but it gets to my point that like, I know you agree with me on this, but the world of streaming is so ephemeral and so transitory that I have trouble thinking about these things as anything other than content in the stream of flotsam and jetsam that just comes and goes. Like, it's like TV in the 1970s, but not the good TV that everybody remembers, like All in the Family. I mean, like, my mother is the car,
right,
or whatever. You know, this whole part of the business makes no sense to me, except as it's just something to watch.
Yeah, and I think we got a big hint actually this week in a Hollywood Reporter article. They hit a profile of Dan Lin, the new head of film for Netflix. I actually like that hire, though I tend not to comment on hires because there's so many factors that determine success or failure. But in that article, they had the line, and I wrote about this in my most important story of the week this week, that said Netflix is going to focus on mid-sized films because that's like comedies, rom-coms, and family films because that's where they've seen their biggest hits. And again, we're talking about the data. I can go look at the genres. And it's like, no, we know Red Notice, Leave the World Behind. They're both thrillers. These are expensive. They have top talent. So there's actually, until you get down to Leo, it's their first family film on the list. And they had a couple other animated films that they bought from Sony that are in, say, the top 15 all time for Netflix. And I don't think it's actually those films are their biggest hits. They're their most profitable films. And that often gets a conversation that we sort of whenever the theatrical versus streaming debate happens, or the inevitable, like, what genre is working, what isn't, we sort of gloss between the total revenue something makes and how much money, how much profit something makes. And those are not interchangeable terms. So I think even Netflix, but, you know, due to that ephemerality, a mid-sized film is just a lower swing because, you know, it's not going to have that long lifetime value unless you can make a sequel for it. That's the one thing we've seen if a film stays on Netflix the whole time, is that when Extraction 2 comes out, Extraction 1 hops back on the list.
Right, that makes sense. And look, this gets to a secondary point that we may have discussed before, but which is, if you're going to spend $200 million, there's no reason, if you are Netflix and you are just trying to rack up hours, there's no reason to spend $200 million on a two-hour motion picture when you can spend $200 million on probably 40 hours of TV.
Right.
That money is again, if you are just talking about getting bang for your buck, it feels like it makes much more sense to make the TV show rather than the film.
And that also ties, again, to a topic we've talked about before, but I think having another year worth of data really sort of cements it, because in my best of charts, I have the top films on the chart laid out between streaming and theatrical. And basically, if it wasn't a Netflix first run streaming film, it was basically a theatrical film, and theatrical actually did very well in the top of the charts versus the other one. I'm just trying to see, what is the first? Yeah, only one other streamer, I think. Yeah, only one other streamer had a first-run film make the top 25 last year, which was Candy Cane Lane on Prime Video, starring Eddie Murphy. So when it comes to that, there was a big move towards blockbusters in the 2000s and 2010s, which everyone blames on the NBAs, you know, like myself. But that was because when you had a blockbuster, the amount of money you could make from it, and when I say money, I mean like actual cash that came into your bank account that you could go either make more movies with or send to shareholders, the upside was much bigger for bigger films. And so you get that demand size return, so you get that longer term value. Plus, you have multiple windows to sell it in. So again, like, I'm not going to mention this filmmaker by name. I'll just hint at him. But he had a big film come out in Christmas this year on Netflix. He's made some other controversial films. He has a lot of fans. And he said more people saw his film than Barbie. I'll call him Zach S just to keep it like vague. And my
That's too obvious. That's too obvious. Okay, you we'll should go Z with Snyder. Z Snyder.
Okay. And now you know who the Simpsons fans were in the early 1990s. So this Z Snyder fellow said, like, more people watch this film than Barbie, to which my response is like, okay, well, where's your several hundred million dollar paycheck that, like, we know Margot Robbie got for starring and producing that film? The answer is he didn't get that paycheck, right? Because there was no other upside besides being a film on Netflix. And relating to that ephemerality, the other thing which, you know, ties to my Ankler article of the week is that when these films do come and they don't go, which I would say Rebel Moon really didn't go because no one's really talking about that one either, and its ratings were not very good, we just never talk about it again. And no one calls it like a huge miss because everyone sort of says, oh, we don't know what the streaming numbers are. And then we move on. So, yeah.
And we don't, and it's hard to quantify what streaming numbers actually mean. I mean, I, you know, when people talk about box office, it's a pretty straightforward, like, it made this many dollars.
Right.
And it costs this much to make, and it probably costs this much to market. And there's some guesswork in there, obviously. But it's like, here are actual, but like, I don't think anybody really in the real world understands how to value an hour viewed or 100 million hours viewed, or, you know, what that actually means. I don't want to defend Zack Snyder here because I am a known Zack Snyder fan. But I will say that I do think two things can be true at the same time. You know, when he says more people saw Rebel Moon than saw Barbie, there, it's entirely possible that's correct. It's entirely possible that more people actually watched his movie because it was available worldwide, because it was streaming, you know, for quote unquote free. It's on Netflix. It's everybody can get it. But it clearly did not have the same kind of cultural impact that something like Barbie had, and beyond box office, you know, talking about Oscars and just the impact it had on the culture at large. Like, I don't think those two things are necessarily mutually exclusive, but it does get back to the point here, which is like, well, what is it actually worth? What does it matter?
Yeah. And again, to quote the, that's where I fall down on this debate is the, I'm blanking on what's the show me the money quote, right?
Jerry Maguire.
Yeah. Jerry Maguire. That is where I fall in, is that no, money actually is the best proxy for essentially, want to call it demand or value something created. Money comes back to being the best thing. To your point, though, the one part I would push back, and I've been pushing back on this since Game of Thrones was battling with Stranger Things in 2019. It was a different time period. But I do think I would actually bet more people did see Barbie globally. Not because you factor in ticket sales, but it's because we still sometimes forget what we don't actually know in the ratings argument. And so what I would say with Barbie, it's a perfect example, is that Barbie came out in theatrical worldwide, and we have those numbers, so we can put it on there. But we don't have the home entertainment rental numbers. Those tend to be harder to get. They tend to be put in dollars. We don't know how to calculate it. And we only have those for the US. But it came out to rent and buy all over the globe, and we don't know those numbers. Then it came out for streaming, again, all over the globe. We only have the US data, and we only have it for a few weeks on HBO Max, but it's actually the only HBO Max film that made the Nielsen top 10 list after it had been released for 4 weeks or more. The Max films, because it's such a smaller service, just don't tend to last that long. We also don't have the ratings for when Barbie is going to come to HBO, the linear channel, for example, or when it'll show up on linear TV, something. So I think what he could say is, if we only track numbers of people we know for sure watched it, Rebel Moon has the edge there because Netflix knows that they can put these numbers out there. Mm-hmm. When you want to talk how many people actually watch Barbie or something, like, again, when Game of Thrones came out, this same issue happened, is that it was the number one movie its final season in almost like every country in Europe and America, but we only had ratings for the US and actually like the UK and Australia. Everyone else would just say it's the number one film or the number one TV show. Stranger Things, we had the global ratings at the time, so people could look at that number, compare it to the US number, and it's not quite the same. That said, again, I go back to measuring the dollar impact. And the other point I've been really trying to make more recently, which I think is going to define the streaming wars and we need to get back, is that the oldest economic principle is that the cheaper something is, the more people consume of it. In streaming, the marginal cost to watch an extra TV show is essentially zero. So you pay your, well, now $15 a month, right, to rent Netflix. If you watch a movie, you didn't actually pay $15 for it, because if you also watch another TV show, you have to factor in that viewing. So essentially you're paying like a dollar or two to watch a movie, and you could watch it with one or two people, versus if you actually go to the movie theater, you're paying $10 on average in America, you know, much higher in certain cities, right, per person. So you just, and that makes sense, because it's saying the demand, you're capturing more of the demand for the people who want to see something sooner. And so, of course, fewer people are going to watch something, because, again, the oldest economic law, the cheaper something is, the more people consume of it. And a lot of the shift to streaming is basically to find that the linear bundle got very expensive, and for a while, streaming was much cheaper, and that's why people consumed more of it.
Yeah. All right. One last thing in the winners category here. The chart that jumped out to me was the top 10 films total hours viewed in 2023 Nielsen in millions. Okay. So the top, here are the top, let's see, seven movies. Number one, Moana. Number two, Encanto. Number three, the Super Mario Brothers movie. Number four, Elemental. Number five, the Minions, Minions, The Rise of Gru. Number six is Sing 2, and number seven is Frozen. And, I mean, look, you look at this chart, and three of the top seven are old Disney movies.
Right.
Not old, they're not Snow White or Sleeping Beauty, but old as in not new. They're not the new releases. They're not what is out recently. And I don't know what to make of this, if it's just a function of those are very popular and kids rewatch things that they know and love. I know that's part of it. If it's there's been a decline in quality over the last two or three years, I think that's probably part of it too. Or if it's just or if it's something else. I mean, I like what do we think is the reason here? And is this why Disney is less worried than maybe it should be about losing subscribers, about subscriber decay?
To start with that last one, because sort of curveball me right at the end. I think it does speak to Disney when they're, especially when it comes to Disney Plus, when they're really focused on their core business, they know they have some of these hits, and they know that these hits will continue to drive value for years. Again, to go back to my analogy earlier, I don't actually think in a lot of cases this is that new of a phenomenon, because it's essentially what we're seeing is all the DVDs people watched in the 2000s and the 1990s. We're capturing all that data, and Disney knows now exactly which DVDs are being rewatched the most. But like, for example, I know in my household when I was growing up, it's like, if you could track Aladdin numbers, right, there would have been a ton of Aladdin VHS, like burning. We also, with the other one, we burned through like Wizard of Oz is the tape, right? So we burned through it because they did that. So this also is somewhat of a data capture issue, because to be clear, the list we were talking about earlier is my list of the top films by how many weeks they appear in the Nielsen top 10. And then Nielsen also provides the top shows and films by total hours viewed throughout the year. And I think this speaks to the stickiness of the best kids content, and the best kids content tends to get rewatched over and over again. And the clear takeaway from that is that Disney is still absolutely the leader in the clubhouse, though Peacock is probably second with their Illumination films, and the success of Super Mario that film is going to be on this chart next year. I would bet like quite a bit that we're going to see this as a top five film next year, because that's how well Mario's been doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right, let's shift to television shows, away from movies to television shows. So again, the Nielsen, biggest show of the year was Ted Lasso, which I think people were surprised by. I know that was somewhat controversial. There was some debate there. Was Ted Lasso actually the biggest new show of the year? And how would you compare that to something like, say, Suits, which was, the big surprise story of streaming in the last 12 months or so?
Yeah. So it was controversial. I actually did. I was one of the people who asked Nielsen. I said, really? Like Ted Lasso? And they double checked the data. And the best explanation for why Ted Lasso is so high up on the charts is that Apple TV Plus gives quite a few free subscriptions out there to customers in the world. And amongst those people they give free subscriptions, they still have a pretty small library overall. And if you're looking for a new show to watch, what that means is Ted Lasso is the buzziest show because it's actually been nominated, I think, in one awards. It's also very well liked by customers with, I believe, an over an 8.0 on IMDb. Again, doing some of these numbers off the top of my head, so I might be wrong. But I know directionally it has a very strong IMDb score. So in that realm, there's Apple TV Plus has quite a few shows, but the one people have probably been talked to about the most is Ted Lasso. So when they turn on an Apple TV Plus subscription, and even though they're only going to have it for 3 or 4 months, they tend to watch Ted Lasso, so it comes across. So to answer your question, yes, amongst new shows, both returning and new shows, Ted Lasso was the winner. It also won the weekly. It had the most total weekly hours. It was a weekly release show, which also helps it in that regard, because if a show is very popular and the episodes come out week to week, you tend to tend to much higher numbers over the course of, like, say, 8 to 12 weeks, which help it versus sort of the Netflix burn bright and collapse down. Now, amongst all TV shows that came to streaming or switched streamers, and that's where Suits comes in, Suits crushes it, and it's not even close. It has, what, 4 times the viewership I'm looking up right now over the weekly. And that's simply because, and this is something that streaming hasn't replicated, it had 8 seasons worth of episodes, and some of those seasons were actually longer cable seasons at the time, as opposed to now we're seeing a lot of shows like the one I remember earlier this year, Griselda, came out starring Sofia Vergara on Netflix, and only had 6 episodes, I think. And so we're seeing a lot more 6 or 8 episodes. So to get up to where you can have over 100 episodes or 8 seasons of a show like Suits, there's just not quite the economic model for streaming. And so that means when everyone hops on board a show like Suits, it rockets to the moon. And so Suits is the number one amongst shows that came from broadcast or cable.
Yeah. I mean, and it's, again, this is a, you know, another kind of data point in the idea of Netflix and streaming in general as the new basic cable, right? Because you look at I mean the acquired second run and library shows chart from Nielsen is it's an order of magnitude bigger. You got Suits is nearly 900 million hours watched, right? NCIS is 529 million hours watched. Grey's Anatomy and The Big Bang Theory are both at 407 million hours watched. I mean, like, these are enormous numbers. And, you know, as much as we like to talk about something like, I mean, Ted Lasso, again, very, very popular, biggest movie or biggest show of the year, 187 million hours viewed, or other buzzy
sorts of things. Reacher, which came out in Christmas, and Reacher ended up was the number 2 returning show of the year, or The Night Agent, you know, was the number 1 debut. Yeah, we talk about those ones when they come out.
The amount of hours viewed, to put it in internet terms, the amount of traffic they drive is dwarfed by these legacy shows.
Yeah. And a streamer needs to have both to do well. And that's actually why I think a lot of the streamers know how valuable the library content is, which is why if they can get someone hooked on one of those shows and they really are rewatching it all the way through, as opposed to burning out bright and having a customer for 3 or 4 weeks, you could have them for 10, 12, you know, even more weeks to watch a show or rewatch a show that they've already watched before. And that actually really helps with the retention and acquisition piece of it, the puzzle. So it's really not about acquiring new customers, it's about keeping them around on the service, and having all those episodes really helps drive that. The problem with streaming has been we just have not seen the episode orders to get streaming native shows up to that volume, and that's partially because the economics just aren't there in streaming, because you just don't make as much per subscription the way you made back in the day with broadcast, where you can pay almost all your costs on the first run and then the syndication window put you over the top, and then you could ride that. Though a lot of shows also got canceled very early there.
Well, let's drill down on this for a second, because I do think this is there's an interesting dichotomy here in terms of what sorts of shows are made. I mean, like, right, so what's the appeal of something like Suits or Friends or Seinfeld, right? Is that you can turn it on and you can flip around. You can watch an episode. It doesn't really matter which episode you watch. You don't have to watch them in order. You do it like the old syndication. You just kind of hit random in your brain and you flip something on. But the shows that have been made for streaming are all in the, or I shouldn't say all, but are largely in the what we could think of as the prestige TV mold, right? You have 8-episode, 10-episode, 12-episode seasons that are telling a discrete story and need to be watched in order. They don't have, you can't hit random on a playlist and just watch, like, I want to watch the 4th episode of the 2nd season of Reacher. I don't have any idea what's going on because I didn't watch the episode before. I'm not going to watch the episode after. I just want to watch the big man punch some people. And, like, I guess you can do that. It's not like the A-Team. It's not like MacGyver, right? To use slightly older references here. These shows are intended to be watched sequentially in order to be, you know, they are not short stories, they are novels. And that has to have a real impact on the rewatchability, the stickiness, the chance that they go viral beyond their first run, right?
Yeah, I actually have in my year end where I talk about the hit films and hit TV shows, I categorize them by genre to sort of answer this very question. And it is, if you look, I have the crime and procedurals in black and comedies in orange. And you look at the acquired chart and the top acquired chart of the top 10, 5 of them are all crime or procedural shows. And the other ones were, and then Walking Dead and Supernatural and Last of Us, I have those as genre shows. But right, so you see this and you also see sitcoms like The Big Bang Theory, Friends. And then you go to the debut shows. And there's only one show that I would call a crime show, which was Beef, but it's not even a procedural. And then there's only one other procedural in the top 25, and that's Poker Face. And there was only one comedy on the list, which was That 90s Show. So the question would be, is this because customers don't want to watch these on streaming, or because streaming hasn't made sitcoms and procedurals yet? And I would actually argue it's the latter, partly because we actually have some news about this, and I wrote about this in my most important story column this week, but Just Max and Netflix both greenlit, I actually called it HBO at first in the article, and was like, gotta fix that typo, but they both greenlit medical procedurals this quarter. And in Netflix's press release, they said, this is our first one. We've never made one before. So how long has Netflix been around? And they just greenlit their first procedural. So it's a genre that they really haven't tried. I would also add that The Lincoln Lawyer, that did very well for Netflix, it's not a procedural per se, but, and I've not watched the show, but it does have a legal element to it. It has a little bit more of a consistent plot in there. It would not surprise me if we see more episodes orders for that to get The Lincoln Lawyer up into an area where it could, say, be syndicated somewhere in the long future. It'll never be quite, you know, episode of the week, but it could get there and be more like that. So my prediction is we're going to see more of those. I don't know about sitcoms. My gut with sitcoms, what we're seeing is the networks know the streamers aren't buying sitcoms, so they're still trying to make sitcoms for broadcast and essentially accumulate up the episodes to have the future sitcoms for streaming. And so Abbott Elementary, I think, falls into that category. I think it's streaming on Max right now, but Nielsen does not report its numbers because it's day after air TV and they don't report a lot of those. I would say CBS with Ghosts, we're seeing the same thing. So the future sitcoms are going to be that. Now, when broadcast eventually dies, what replaces that? I don't know. Sitcoms are going to have to go somewhere. I actually think the fast distribution method, that's the free advertising supported streamers like Tubi, Pluto, Roku Channel, Amazon, Freevee to a lesser extent. I actually think the linear feeds there, might encourage the sort of procedural sitcom element because the format will just lend itself to that as well. And then we'll see if the streamers ever adopt more linear streaming on their own platforms.
This, I again, this is more in the realm of theory, and maybe you don't have an opinion on this, but I have long, I have for a long, long time thought and argued that there is something specific about the syndication model, about the idea of giving control away to the programmer, you know, of TBS or TNT or whoever, and just kind of sitting there and watching, like, okay, here's it's 5 p.m. I'm going to throw on Fox 5 DC WTTG, and I'm going to watch whatever the Simpsons episode that they have coming on right. is going to be. And I do wonder if the sitcom can exist without that syndication model working, right? Like, I just don't know. I don't know that audiences, I guess this is an audience question as much as a programming question. I don't know that audiences want to watch things that they are not already familiar with. I think that taking away control from the viewer is a very key factor in the success and longevity of things like Seinfeld, Simpsons, right. Friends, Big Bang yep. Theory, et cetera, et cetera. And without that model, I think the sitcom kind of withers and dies as a format.
So that's why I think the FAST model could bring it back. And again, I also think the linear channel model. And this is one of those issues, again, like I say, I'm the entertainment strategy guy, but I don't know everything. From what I've heard, there might be some costs associated with linear streams. But this is one of those issues where, like, if I were Disney or I were Max, I would be much better on the linear streams I offer people within my app so that I could push some of those things. Because, again, to your point, I also think some of this relates to kids' shows because I have two youngins and I've been through the streaming wars with them picking shows. And it's funny to me how unoptimized streaming is for kids' shows because they're like, rewatch the first episode of this show again. Where back in the day, it was like, you know, I was like telling my daughter, it's like when I wanted to watch X-Men animated series, I had to be there when it started at 10 o'clock on Saturday or I wasn't going to watch it. So like we like set our clocks and we watched it because we were going to watch some X-Men. But you would watch whatever episode was there. So you would get them and say, with the kid show, it could come out of order. I think the linear consumption of TV customers really do like. The growth of the FAST over the last year is proof of that. Again, they're also cheaper because they're free. Some of them also really don't have full ad load. So if you can only get two or three ads for an hour of TV, that's a pretty good deal. But I think that method of consumption can get people back onto watching it. Because like I think in the 2010s, my wife and I decided to check out Modern Family. And I think we watched the show completely out of order. You'd have to like guess how, like what year it was by how old everyone was on the show. Because the shows, you know, the episodes would just run at any given time. So I think there is something to that with the sitcom. I don't think it'll work with on-demand streaming because to your point, people want that coherent story. But if the linear model keeps growing, I think we might see more animated shows. We might see more sitcoms that don't have to be watched in order if the plot isn't that tight, because a linear distribution model will encourage that. Now, when will the streamers listen to me? I don't know. Maybe never.
Well, and this is, I mean, you can point to something like Bluey as an example of a show that I think is an enormous success that can be watched out of order, that is frequently watched out of order. Kids, you know, just throw on. And it's funny, whenever we're in a hotel with my children and we need to just throw, we'll throw on Disney, the Disney channel, not even Disney Plus, because it's like whatever's on the, the hotel TV. And whenever we do that, there's like a 5 out of 10 chance that it's a Bluey episode. And then it's maybe either like a Spidey and His Amazing Friends or whatever. But like whatever, they'll just watch it. It doesn't matter. It's, you know, if they'll zone out as I need them to.
Right. And that's why I think zombies. Amongst the streamers, I actually, for every streamer, I think incorporating linear channels into their main feed would be really valuable. Netflix, we know, is doing a lot of live shows. I just discovered collecting data this week that they have a new live cooking show with Dave Chang. again, speaking to awareness, like, I don't know. It's never made the charts, so that's why I didn't track it at first. It's been going on for since January, and it's a live once a week show to get people to tune in. I think that's really smart. I think a lot of their moves to like the WWE deal, which I think we discussed back and forth on newsletters, you saying, yeah, I stole your thunder, which I totally did, on purpose too. But I think to make WWE even more valuable, having those linear streams would help. And I even think for Netflix's back catalog, it's one thing to, obviously their recommendation algorithm is best in the streaming game. But if you have just a channel that you had up top of Netflix that was a linear stream for people to watch, you could pull up some shows from your back catalog that people hop into. And it wouldn't work for every show, but I think a surprising amount of them would. Same with Disney. They have a ton of Mickey Mouse cartoons. Searching their UX to find them is a nightmare. So figuring out a way, just having a stream, because again, a Mickey Mouse cartoon, I don't need to watch it in order. I don't care which one it is. You just turn it on and people will start watching, or the kids, you know, in particular, will start watching it. And, you know, Max could benefit from just having a linear streams of the Big Bang Theory and Friends, because those are in the 2000s, probably the two biggest shows on syndication. So clearly people will hop in and just watch an episode to see what's happening.
Can I ask I'm going to ask a dumb question here. Maybe, or maybe it's not dumb. Maybe it's actually a brilliant question. But let me posit an idea. Is it possible for Netflix to combine the idea of the fast style linear stream with the personalized algorithm? So, like, instead of having you throw on Netflix and there's everybody in the world can watch, here's our WWE stream, here's our cooking stream, you know, whatever. Instead of that, it's here's Sonny's WWE stream. We notice you like watching Bret the Hitman Hart matches, so we're going to give you a bunch of those, and we're going to throw in an Owen Hart for a tearjerker. You know, like, is that not, technically feasible? Is that like, or does it even defeat the purpose of the linear stream? Is part of the purpose of the linear stream having people watch the same thing at the same time?
So I tend to default to doing both, but what you're describing is technically feasible, because essentially it's what the algorithm does right now. You know, when the algorithm pops up this show for you to watch, the algorithm is already tracked on what type of things you and your family or whoever's on your profile watch. And then it's offering you shows like that to try and get you to click on them. The linear stream would just take them on and have a list of them and say, here, click on this, and you can start watching right in the middle. I would just combine that with some curation, because I actually think, you know, until AI replaces all of us, I think human curation is valuable to either push things or get people to discover things that they haven't seen before. For Netflix, they have such a large library, and since they have the industry best recommendation algorithm, they would probably benefit the most from that. Disney, not counting the Hulu content, but the Disney Plus, it's just a much smaller, more valuable library. So you can do a lot more human curation there and take essentially what your top brands are. And again, like, you don't need to curate what exact Marvel movie I want to rewatch. I just need to see that a Marvel movie's on midway through, and I'm going to click on it to see what scene it is, right? And that's what, like, half of cable television movies are some combination of superhero movies or big budget or Harry Potter films, right? So I would think you can do a combination of it, but your ideas actually would be a great one. But the one thing with Netflix is, so far, while they are doing live events, they have been the most opposed to anything that reeks of linear streams. And there's always been rumors that they're going to try and do that. But even when they've tried to make Discover, it's still been in an on-demand way. And I haven't defined these terms. I assume most people are business people. But linear means a stream of TV that comes in that you can't really start or stop very well, and it's sort of just coming. That compares to live, which is a stream of something that's happening in the actual moment, versus on-demand, which is scrolling to something, picking it, and it's on. So those are the three terms used. But yeah, Netflix is opposed on-demand. So even then, they headed a function a little while ago that I think they deprecated, which was like, just show me something to watch, where you're supposed to click on something and it would just pop up a random episode of something. But so much of their content was serialized that it just didn't really work, you know, to hop into a middle of an episode of Beef if you've never watched it, you know.
Right. All right. blah, 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 blah. All right, let's get to the big yep. streaming flops, the flops, bombs, misses. One thing that jumped out was the overall that Disney Plus, for all the talk about how bad a year Disney has been having, that Disney Plus did not really have a ton of like straight up misses. Yep. Did not have a ton of, at least in the TV side of things. Yep.
Yeah, and it surprised me as well. And so everyone knows my methodology for this. I'm collecting throughout the year multiple rating sources, primarily Nielsen, but also Show Labs by Plum Research, Samba TV's weekly top 10 list and their Datactotes. And then I look at a few other things like IMDb rankings, TV Time, Just Watch that provide these rankings. And so I have two levels. One is a show I call Dog Not Barking, which is increasingly rare, but it means a show can come out and it doesn't end up on any platform, any measurement, and I never see it. So it's like, it's almost like it never existed because no one watched it, and half the time no one will even comment it. And so those are Dogs Not Barking. Then I also have misses, because the important thing for a show or a film when it misses isn't just that it didn't make the charts or that its ratings are low, but it's how much did it cost to make that. So certain shows got this opposite of prestigious award because they're really expensive, the biggest one being Citadel, which I don't know if we'll talk about. So I make that list. I exclude most unscripted shows, most reality shows, because they tend to be cheaper. They tend not to be as big as swings. And I exclude, for the most part, foreign-made TV shows, because as I've written about before, while we have seen some big foreign language hits, for the most part, most foreign language shows just don't travel very well in the U.S. So I agreed that Disney did not have as many hits on television as everyone thought they would. They started the year off strong with Mandalorian, but Secret Invasion was a disappointment. It was also cost a lot of money. And then they had a few other ones. But in the back half of the year, they had really dialed back how many shows they made. So they did not have a lot of huge misses. And most of the shows they made, like Ahsoka and Goosebumps and I'm missing one. Oh, Percy Jackson, all made the charts for multiple weeks. So in the second half of 2023, they actually had very, very few misses compared to some of the other streamers.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like Disney Plus is smartly, to my mind, shifting to more of a HBO model from the 90s mm-hmm. or early aughts, where they have a couple shows that are kind of must-watch right. if you're in a certain demographic, rather than flooding the zone with tons of stuff.
Yep.
Hulu is an interesting case because Hulu is also in the Disney family. So Hulu, had kind of a disastrous year. And I say this as somebody who, like, if I canceled all of my subscriptions, Hulu would be the last one to go because I'm like one of the five people who is watching these shows apparently. But
that's
stuff like
Max
Murder
for
at
you?
The End of the World.
It's past, because wasn't Max your old number one?
Yeah, it has passed Max. Well, Max is a disaster for a bunch of reasons, mostly because Max used to be my number one surfing streamer, right? I would go there and I would just like click around till I found something to watch. And now I'm so annoyed by the homepage that I never go there anymore. Yeah. I just never go. I don't want to watch any of the dumb Discovery Plus shows that are on my homepage. And I know I can click over to HBO or films right. or whatever. But I like find it offensive, frankly. I find it offends my sensibilities. So I have basically stopped going there. But Hulu,
so
I love
it. Is.
Hulu
okay.
is great.
Yeah.
So Hulu had a bad 2023, right. but it seems to be turning things around. Shogun was a big hit, big surprise.
Yeah. So what I would say with Hulu, Shogun is a huge hit. It's their biggest hit they've had going back to 2021 when they had back-to-back Only Murders in the Building and Nine Perfect Strangers, which were two of their highest rated ones. And then Only Murders being a half hour has obviously spawned the whole series. It's also, I would argue in some ways, it might be one of the funniest shows on streaming. I label a lot of shows as comedies, but they come with that asterisk that it's like, you know, but you don't laugh at this comedy. It's just, you know, a comedy.
It's a chuckle comedy.
Yeah, exactly. Where Only Murders in the Building has two of like comedy legends, right? Trying to like just deliver yeah. jokes as much as they can. And so that was their last peak. So Shogun has not turned things around, but they have another hit. They also have a hit in The Bear. The problem is when we're talking hit rate, and this is something I always try and emphasize, like if you make enough TV shows, most development execs are going to make a show or two that are very, very good. They will hang their hat on those shows for the rest of time. And so even looking at, say, the streamer level. So, like, again, if you look, and this is just the back half of the year, you know, Murder at the End of the World, Artful Dodger, Better, Black Cake, Culprits, Faraway Downs, The Hardy Boys, Letter Kenny, Living for the Dead, Love and Fairhope, Nada, Obituary, The Other Black Girl, Reservation Dogs, Shoresy, Spellbound, Such Brave Girls, This Fool. And I left out the unscripted shows and a bunch more unscripted shows that are in there. That's, they made a lot of shows. So to have Shogun hit, to have had The Bear hit in 2022 and have a very successful second season, it's good. It's better. If they didn't have those, it would be like a disaster. But that's not enough to have said they really turned it around. So I actually think Disney is actually, their hit rate is extremely high right now. Hulu's hit rate has not quite gone there. And I also think Hulu is a little bit of, they don't actually quite know what type of streamer they want to be. So they essentially dabble, they dabble in everything without having a clear identity that I think Paramount, Reacher, and Max, HBO's Max brand has. And then Netflix also dabbles in everything, but they're the market leader, so they're able to pull that off.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, Hulu, when I say I go to Hulu a lot, mostly what I do is I watch FX shows. I watch the FX on Hulu. And FX has always been one of my favorites, but FX is also, it's niche. Right. That's a niche. It's like, it's like a smaller version of HBO. You know, I love what they do, but it is never going to be, those shows are never going to put up Netflix numbers.
I think they've also always punched above their weight in critical acclaim, which is good, but it's not the same thing as what customers want to watch. And so that's why I think they've struggled with some of those FX shows again when they break out, like The Bear or Fargo, you know, which we don't get ratings for because it's day after air TV. Shogun, they're calling a streaming original, so we are getting the day after air ratings. They're also very good anyways. You can get for that, but I just think it shows that the audience is a little more limited than people would have it believe for FX. And so that's why I think Hulu needs something else, but it'll be interesting when this Disney Plus Hulu mashup comes shortly to see how that affects everything. I also think the other strength Hulu has that we really don't have visibility in, because again, Nielsen doesn't track day after air TV, is they can also super serve a lot of the customers with the day after air broadcast shows, like 911 is on there, Abbott Elementary is on there, a lot of the other ABC shows are on there. And so they can deliver some of that more broad-based shows, but as we move to a more and more streaming-only future, I don't know that the Hulu development teams are actually developing those broad-based originals. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah. All right. So let's. All right. We're it's taken us 48 minutes to get to the controversy or not controversy. But let's talk about the supposed double standard here between how we talk about what Netflix and what Apple and what Amazon Prime do, as opposed to what the standard studio based streamers, the ones owned by Disney or Warner Brothers or Universal, what they do. So what, in your opinion, what is the double standard here? Why does it exist?
So the basic double standard is that over time, as you know, Netflix came up as a streamer that was disrupting the industry, and they got a lot of street cred for that. And they were genuinely one of the most disruptive companies of the last, you know, 14 years, right? Moving the streaming, getting people to go over. And then Amazon was also very quickly in copying them. But honestly, so was Hulu, which was owned by all the traditional services. But since that time, there's always been an idea that in a lot of the coverage I read, when we talk about the strategy of the streamers, we talk about the strategies of the Netflixes, the Amazons, the Apples now, and the Googles in one way. And we talk about the strategies of the traditional streamers in a completely opposite way. And sometimes, and this is what my article tried to relay, it's the exact same strategy, but it gets condemned when it's done by the traditional studios for whatever reason. And when it comes to the streamers, it's like in some cases they can do no wrong. Now, partly this gets excused, and there's like a branch of this which I write about in my Inkler article, that is, oh, you have to understand, it doesn't matter if they do bad strategy because Apple and Amazon and Google have so much money, it doesn't matter. And this is true, but that doesn't mean we call bad strategic decisions good strategic decisions. They're still bad. They're still losing money. It just doesn't matter. If that's the case, you know, I'm assuming Apple and Amazon lose money simply because we know how much they're spending and we know how much bigger they are compared to the other streamers. And so they're outspending them. And brought up a few examples, for example, like when certain shows get unordered on, which I actually didn't, which I only mentioned briefly, you know, if a streamer had ordered a show and unorders it, it's like, oh, okay, well, they decided not to make that show. But if a traditional studio does, we could think pieces about how, is this the end of Hollywood? And it's a betrayal of actors' trust for like weeks and weeks on end.
Right. So let's talk about that specific example, because I do think that this is the most glaring double standard. Right. But there was some pushback on this. I'll acknowledge pushback here. So quite famously, Warner Brothers decided to shelve Batgirl, take a tax write off, right, throw the digital file in the trash forever. No one's ever going to see it until it leaks 10 years from now. And then also Coyote versus Acme, which is a Looney Tunes cartoon. They're still shopping it around technically, but I would say the odds are better than even that it ends up almost exactly the same as Batgirl, even though I would argue that they should put it in theaters. That's an argument for another time.
Who have kids, I also think they should put it in theaters because the calendar's empty and it's now generated enough, just take a shot.
It's crazy. But it's crazy to me that they don't just spend $20 million on Facebook and Twitter and YouTube ads and put it in theater. Whatever.
But I interrupted you, and I'll address that point. But yeah.
Neither here nor there. And then you have Netflix. Now Netflix has a movie that's in the can. It stars Halle Berry. It's a sci-fi action-y type movie. It's an original, so there's a little bit of difference there between that and the IP brand maintenance that Warner Brothers is worried about. And Netflix has basically said, we're not releasing this. We're throwing it in the trash can too. And with Batgirl and Coyote versus Acme, everybody got extremely mad at David Zaslav and Warner Brothers and said he hates art, he hates artists, this is a disaster for the people who worked on this movie, they deserve to have their work seen, blah, blah, blah. Happens with Netflix, and nobody really says anything. Now, part of this again is the IP issue. There, you don't have legions of Halle Berry stans on the internet saying we need all the Halle Berry content, right, even though we should have those. We need more Halle Berry content. And then there was a secondary argument. Somebody in my Twitter feed was like, oh, that's not fair. You can't compare the two. Those two movies were done at Warner Brothers. They were done and they were supposedly good. And, you know, but this Halle Berry movie, they need to do reshoots. It's going to be expensive to get everybody there. So it's not really the same thing. And like, okay, fine. That's an excuse, but it doesn't change the basic calculus here, which is that you are taking the thing that lots of people have worked on, that lots of people, if that is the standard at which we are working, if we're working on the labor theory of value and worth, then the Halle Berry movie is just as valuable as the other two movies, and nobody said boo. Nobody could even tell you that there is a Halle Berry movie that has been thrown in the trash. Nobody knows about it. And that's because there wasn't a weeks-long freakout in the entertainment media about it. Why the double standard?
Why the double standard? Yeah. So again, my theory for partly why the double standard exists is that the legacy media has just been around longer, and there are some people who just sort of love big tech, and big tech is also very successful. And the reasons why are multifaceted as opposed to boiling it down to one thing. But, you know, I think one thing that benefits them is they have just tremendous size, and that gives them tremendous influence, including giant PR departments that are also very aggressive of giving scoops and things like that. To the point, though, with the amount of pushback, which I disagree with, I believe Batgirl actually had to do special effects work. And on some of the other shows and films that have been canceled by like Disney and others had VFX works to do. As we know, that can actually be very expensive, and when people rush it, it actually looks bad, which was plaguing a lot of movies in the 2022-2023 timeframe. So it probably had as much cost as the mothership. So I don't think that's actually a super honest explanation. I also think we saw a lot of the same thing with Disney and Paramount when they were unordering shows. They'd given them green lights for second seasons, and they said, oh, takesie backsies, we're not going to greenlight your show anymore. But again, Amazon did that to The Peripheral, and it did it to a Spider-Man TV show. And again, they didn't get the pushback. So I don't think that argument's fair. Every show is going to have these little, or film is going to have these nuances, but I don't think those are fair. I think the IP issue is a legitimate complaint. I didn't address it specifically. But then I think this actually gets back to the double standard, is it's like, oh, yes, we care about when Disney has failures with Marvel movies because we all love the IP. And we don't care about Netflix or Amazon's IP at all. And then you're like, okay, well, then why do you say that Netflix and Amazon are taking over the world? You just said you don't care about their shows and films at all and they're garbage. But then you're also like, but they're also taking over the world. They're unstoppable. No one will ever be able to compete with them. The other factor that I think drives a lot of this discussion, especially in, say, the last 2 years with what has happened, is when we shifted from the profit or from the growth mindset that Netflix essentially benefited from very low interest rates and a focus on growth at all costs for the first 10 years. And right when the linear channels, the traditional streamers decided, sorry, traditional studios decided, okay, we have to get into streaming now because it's achieving critical mass. So we're going to get in and we're going to lose a bunch of money because frankly, that's what Netflix did for a decade. And that's what it takes to make it in the streaming wars. Again, we don't know if Apple or and Amazon are losing money, but you know, my rule of thumb is if someone's making tons of money, they tend to tell you about it. And you know, Google now tells us how much YouTube makes, and for years they didn't, right? So maybe they're making tons of money and just not telling anyone about it in their specific media adventures, but we don't know. But right around the when COVID hit, there's a brief surge, and then Wall Street realized that all their growth targets were wildly off, something I had been predicting back in like 2019 timeframe. And so they said, oh, we don't want growth anymore. We want profit at all costs. And so essentially the studios have all suffered from that. And the fact that streaming isn't as good of a business model means Netflix can only compare itself to its old self. And so it's looking very good. The traditional studios are all comparing themselves to much better businesses when you had thriving theatrical, home entertainment, and linear TV. And those comparisons just don't look as good. So it's easy to jump on them. Even though their streaming can be successful, it just doesn't look as good as their old businesses looked. And again, for Apple and Amazon, we have a dearth of information. And just not knowing means people give them the benefit of the doubt. Now, I would love my proposed solution that will never happen, and I love to make proposed solutions that will never happen, would be that either the SEC or the FCC said, hey, you know what? If your business line gets reported into the CEO of the company and you make, say, $1 billion, or you have $1 billion in costs, you got to get broken out into your own unit in your 10K. And then just having that visibility would, I think, make a more level playing field. Now, Apple and Amazon will never do this voluntarily. As far as I know, the SEC is not going to force them to do it. But just knowing would change the entire nature of the conversation, because right now we have the financials for some of the companies competing in streaming, and we have no idea for three of the biggest.
Yeah, and it's a tricky conversation, because I'm like torn between caring a great deal and not, and like thinking I should not be caring about this at all. Frankly, I should just be thinking about like how good is a thing, and is, and that's what matters. But this is an age old fight between art and commerce, and the reason it exists is because movies and TV shows are expensive as heck. Right. To make. They, like, you cannot separate the two. You simply cannot separate the two. Otherwise, everybody would be spending, you know, $200 million on Ridley Scott movies because they want to hang out with the guy who made Blade Runner. And you can't do that because it doesn't work as a business. But it does change what gets made and what doesn't get made.
Yeah. And I think the not knowing I think impacts what gets made and what doesn't get made and what's good and what's not good. Or what I try and emphasize, because again, I've never been trained in the dark arts of, you know, critical review, like the critics out there in the world, yourself. But I just focus on what's popular. And I think when you have the disconnect between knowing what's popular, which tends to correlate very highly with what makes money, that tends to also lead to a lot of bad decisions because you just don't have the forcing function. You know, it's like the analogy I make is, you know, a company having a ton of money to start a new business in a lot of ways can sometimes make worse decisions or create worse structures because there's not that financial pressure that if you get it wrong, you're going to go out of business, right? I read an article where someone talked about the boondoggle that was Quibi. It's like a bad swing in entertainment. And I just find the Quibi example hilarious because, you know, if Quibi were inside of Apple or Amazon, it would still exist. It would still be putting out shows, and people would probably be touting these weird metrics to talk about how effective it is for all the things they did. You know, we saw that with Snapchat for years, was pushing how well its originals were doing. Then they quietly shut down the whole business because clearly, like, no matter how well they were doing, they weren't actually making money. I read one article that was a little vague on details, but it implied that Twitch has never actually made money for Amazon. And it's been there for 8 years. So has Twitch lost more money than Quibi? We have no idea. We know Quibi burned through its cash pile, but does that mean it had a worse strategy than Twitch has? Again, they're losing the same amount of money. So this is, and I know for you, you're talking about what's good, but I write for, you know, fellow people who work in the industry as like a strategy analyst. And that's why I really try and hold two separate ideas, essentially that this quad chart of who's in a really good situation and who has a really good strategy and who's in a bad situation and who has a bad strategy. Presumably they're going to go right out of business. But I think that's like an interesting, those are two different issues. And I just don't think we need to confuse them because otherwise you lead to people making bad decisions.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, that's kind of the point of this show is it's a business of showbiz. This is it's what we talk about here.
Yeah.
Hopefully everyone enjoys it. All right. That is everything I wanted to ask you. What do you think folks should know? As you know, I like to close by asking if there's anything I should have asked. What should folks know about the state of streaming, winners, losers, what people should be looking for? What's up?
I'll go off the board. I think I did piracy last time I was on. So again, the industry keeps failing to address piracy, so I'm not going to mention that again. But if I were making the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, piracy would be on there. I would also put that streaming is just not as valuable as business model. But the third one, which I've written a few times about, would be AI, which I know has been discussed on like across the movie aisle. It's been discussed everywhere. Only caution I would make is just not to make predictions about how good or bad AI is going to be. Especially if you say AI is never going to improve, because I listened to a podcast last year where someone's like, when is AI going to be able, I'll click, make me a scene, and out pops a scene. And he's like, that might be years away. And the answer, and this was a podcast from like May of last year, and the answer was like February of this year. So AI is going to be fascinating. I think we're going to see a lot of its uses on YouTube amongst creators first, because it's going to lower costs. But that's the issue I am definitely looking at. But the other concern I have with it is really going to be on the cost side, because people are spending a fortune. And in some cases, the numbers people describe are more than, you know, the entertainment industry makes in a year. So if that's what your costs are, then people aren't going to be able to use your programs to make these videos. So I'm fascinated by AI. And it's the one that with piracy, I think we should be talking about like every month or 2 months or 3 months in the entertainment sphere, because it's easy to forget about them. Especially piracy, but they're all big and important.
Yeah. All right. Thank you to the Entertainment Strategy Guy for coming on with me. I will include links to the things we discussed. Make sure you sign up for his newsletter. It is one of my must reads every week. So I am always happy to get you on. Thanks for being on.
Appreciate it, and thanks for having me.
All right. Once again, my name is Sonny Bunch. I am culture editor at The Bulwark, and I will be back next week with another episode of The Bulwark Goes to Hollywood. We'll see you guys then.